You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. The Radio Cafe is brought to you today by the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation. After a warm winter with lots of beautiful blue skies but very little moisture, the city is calling on its residents to renew our water conservation efforts. Visit facebook.com/savewatersantafe to take the new online water quiz and learn how to save water and contribute long-term to keeping Santa Fe green and healthy. You'll also find out how to earn hundreds and even thousands of dollars by making your home and workplace more water-wise. That's facebook.com/savewatersantafe. And thanks to the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation for sponsoring the Radio Cafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Pedram Shojai. He's an author, teacher, filmmaker. He's a doctor of Oriental medicine, a former Taoist monk. He's the founder of Well.org. He's host of the podcast The Urban Monk. And he's working on a new film series called Interconnected, which is about the microbiome. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So there's a lot of talk these days about the human microbiome. What exactly do we even mean by that term?
It's complicated, right? I think a lot of people who talk about it don't know what they're talking about, and most people you talk to about it don't even know what it is. It's the ecosystem of life that lives inside of us. It's bacteria, nematodes, parasites, viruses, all of it. The body is filled with these little bugs, and we used to think it was gross. We used to think it was pathology. Now we're realizing that much of our health, much of our immunity, much of our happiness, all kinds of things that we've kind of taken for granted have been attributed to the delicate balance of life inside our bodies.
So all of these little creatures, which are genetically very much not us, are supporting us. What do they actually do?
You name it, right? It's like you walk out on the street in Manhattan. It's like, what does everyone do there? Every one of them has a role. They function as a community and the ecosystem. It's like when bad neighbors show up, the good ones will help offset and mitigate the damage. And sometimes bad invaders will come in, or antibiotics will come in and wipe out a neighborhood. And then, you got to grow the trees all over again. And it's very complicated because we are just starting to understand what all these bugs do, what kinds of foods they thrive on, what kinds of other bugs they cooperate with best. And what one of the most exciting parts of the field is what the kind of metabolome is what substances come out of there, what they poop, basically. And that might be a biofilm that's an antibiotic for other bad bugs, or it might be butyrate, which, helps us with our inflammatory cascade. So there's so many things we're realizing that we don't actually necessarily produce ourselves, but they do for us, like our B vitamins, right? And so it's opened up this kind of wild, wild west area of medicine where, I've spent, several months now in the ivory towers of the best research institutions, and there's genuine excitement and enthusiasm because we're looking in the wrong place. And it turns out that a lot of our healthcare dilemmas and our healthcare solutions are going to come from really the genetic material of these bugs that are working with us.
It's such a complex example of symbiotic relationships because these are bugs who probably evolved long before we did. I mean, they're single-celled and small multicellular organisms that have existed in nature before Homo sapiens were crawling around, presumably. Do we know how it came about that they became such an integral part of us, like the evolutionary process?
It's an interesting question, and the way you've phrased it, and we all do this, is it's a very human-centric question. We evolved out of them, not the other way around, right? So they've been around doing this for billions of years. And, a bunch of the photosensitive ones that found benefit in being together evolved into something that eventually became an eyeball, right? And so these little eukaryotic cells were late to the game. So first there was these kind of these simple cells that existed. And then something special happened where a type of bacteria made it into a cell, which became a eukaryotic cell. And so this thing called mitochondria, which is how we started generating energy to, the point where we were, we had positive cash flow. We were doing really well. And that led to further growth, adaptation, and development. which eventually became multi-celled, you know, organisms and rats and eventually us. This all kind of came out of this symbiotic cooperation of bacteria millions and millions and millions of years ago. And we're the end result, but we're not who we think we are. We're a community of life that cannot exist without them.
Define eukaryotic.
So it's just prokaryotic, eukaryotic. Eukaryotic are the ones that have the nucleus, and in the nucleus we have the mitochondria. Mitochondria is where we're able to take simple sugars and turn them into much more energy or ATP than we previously were as prokaryotic cells. And therefore, you know what? The gig is good, right? And so as you can produce more energy, life can replicate faster, and you could start having more and more iterations of life. So the evolutionary cycle started to kind of accelerate. And it's really interesting. It's actually called into question, at least for me, parts of Darwinian evolution, because it seems that life has always worked together in a symbiotic way and co-conspired to adapt and develop in what some would call this kind of pinnacle of you know, evolution, which is us, which, you know, I would argue has started to de-evolve in the last, you know, couple generations with the advent of industry and chemicals that the body is unfamiliar with, and, you know, sedentary lifestyles and all. But the body which we inhabit, you know, who knows what this thing even is at this point? I mean, we're just made up of trillions and trillions of cells, many of which are not us. It has this magical communication network between us and the life around us that has signaling between us and the environment, that has signaling between the environment and our mitochondria. And the whole thing, all of it is just like interconnected, right? So we're calling the series that. It's just woven together with such just beautiful precision and elegance that it's just staggering.
I mean, when we think of Darwinian evolution, as you're saying, it's about every species looking out for itself and trying to survive. It's not about interspecies mutual aid. And I wonder, I mean, are the cells that are helping us, that are in our guts and other places in our bodies, these beneficial bacteria and other microorganisms, are they trying to help us, or are they just doing what they've always done and try to survive, and this is a good ecosystem niche?
I think probably the latter, and it's hard to extrapolate that, obviously, but, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of thing. And so, you know, it's just these symbiotic co-ops of like, hey, you know, let's bond together. When those bad guys come, you know, I got your back, you got mine. And it's just worked in this way where symbiotically this symphony has started to kind of play. And it's all been pretty well oiled until we started adding a lot of these heavy metals that weren't used to being in our food chain and our, you know, our lungs and all that.
Like lead and things from car exhaust.
Yeah, diesel particulate and all that. And then also chlorocarbons and fluorocarbons and all these pesticides and all these chemicals that have been added that our bodies don't know what to do with. And that's really been a major disruptor of this symphony of life. And so, you know, every doctor that's worth anything that I know is really actively looking at detox pathways, saying, look, you got to avoid the toxins. You got to, you know, help your body detox this stuff, and you got to go back to nature, right? You got to eat food that comes from the earth and you know, ferments, and don't be worried about the dirt, right? And that's where people are getting healthy again.
How long does it take from when a child is born, and presumably, at least when it's in utero, is made up entirely of its own genetics, right? And then when it passes out of the mother, it picks up some bacteria and stuff on the way out, and then a whole process starts. What does that look like?
Yeah, it's interesting. We used to think that in the amniotic fluid, there was just nothing, and now we're finding bacteria in there as well, right? And so it's signaling. But for the most part, it is kind of a sterile environment. I mean, it's, you know, the baby is obviously being exposed to whatever mom's being exposed to through the bloodstream, right, through the placenta. So mom's having a, you know, an issue with someone's perfume in a elevator. Baby gets that signaling still, and baby still has their, you know, kind of nascent immune system starting to develop. But yeah, I mean, I guess you could say our first kind of inoculation, right, the nature vaccine as you come through the vaginal canal. That's why it's so important to really emphasize vaginal birth. is that's where the first kind of bolus of bacteria that the baby is exposed to hits in the eyes, in the nose, down the mouth, swallow all of it. And that seed colony of bacteria that comes from really the health of the mother's colony, right? The mom's vaginal health comes from mom's gut health and all of it, overall health, is that then becomes kind of the signature of the world that this baby is coming into, which then informs the immune system to say, okay, look, this is stuff you got to look out for. You know, this is what we have in our food supply, and, you know, this is probably not good for you.
Now, we know that these creatures are in our gut, but they're in other places in our bodies. You mentioned the vagina. Where else are they, and what is their function in various places in the body?
We're just starting to figure this out. So yes, they're in the vagina, they're on the skin, all over the skin. Turns out they're on liver tissue. Turns out they're in breast tissue. Turns out they're floating around the blood, what we used to think was sepsis and, like, you know, emergency time. No, there's bacteria there too. Turns out almost every type of tissue in the body has bacteria that are supposed to be there. And oftentimes when we find cancer in the body, there are bacteria that are not supposed to be there. So this is brand new. It's opening up a whole new field of research in medicine, and a lot of people scratching their heads saying, oh my goodness, we've been looking at this all wrong. And to that point, we used to study cells in isolation. We'd put them in a petri dish and we'd be like, okay, what does it do? And now it turns out that if that cell isn't surrounded by the environment, the ecosystem, the friends that it's used to being around, it's like in a psych ward in isolation. It doesn't behave the same. And so once you surround those cells with the bacteria that they're accustomed to signaling with, then they behave the way they normally behave in vivo, in humans.
It's like that now famous experiment about the mice. You put mice in separate cages and they get addicted to drugs, but you put them in a community of other mice and they ignore the very same drugs.
Yep. And so we found that, you know, what do we do with cancer patients, right? We isolate. And so isolation is not how nature works. It's integration. And so there's this web of life that has a communication network that we're just starting to become aware of, let alone understand. Turns out that's where it's all happening. And that's where the future of medicine, like, you know, I'm not talking, kind of metaphysical woo-woo here. I'm talking about the top scientists and the top research institutions all over the world are looking at this saying, oh my God, now what?
Well, tell us more about the cancer piece, because you just mentioned that there are cases where they're associating certain kinds of bacteria with certain kinds of cancer.
It's not that direct. They're just finding some correlation. And so, you know, this is really early on, so I want to make sure we're very clear that we don't know.
Right.
But we can say that when we find breast cancer, around it, there tends to be bacteria that aren't supposed to be there. And the healthy breast tissue has different kinds of bacteria. We're not there yet, but it's very interesting. And there's some studies I've looked at where it's just, you know, taking, pounds of usage of antibiotics on a state-by-state basis, and looking at the incidence of cancer, and they're almost directly in line. It's just like, holy crap, I hope that's not the, oh, is that?
Yeah.
We don't know, but it's starting to point to things that are very, I mean, think about it, antibiotic against life,
right?
So if you're wholesale killing life and killing off the organisms that are here to help support this web of life, every time you have an ear infection or something, then maybe we've taken a drastically wrong turn, and it's a time to reevaluate how we administer any drugs. Not to say antibiotics don't save lives, but the targeted use of antibiotics has become a very big thing. Finding antibiotics that are very specific for, you know, ENT infections versus taking a pill that kills everything.
Right. And you know, there's another analogy in nature, which is pesticides. For every pest insect, there's some huge number of beneficial insects. But when you spray a pesticide, you kill them all. And so then whatever of the pest survives proliferates because you've killed all the little creatures that eat it.
Yep. And that's what happens in the gut, too. And so, you know, some of them will stay and a lot of weeds will start growing. When you clear cut a forest, you know, it takes a long time to bring it back. And some of the kind of early, more aggressive types of plants and species come back. Same thing in the gut. When we take these antibiotics and we're just kind of napalming the whole thing, if we're not careful in how we re-inoculate, I mean, we're losing a lot of diversity. I mean, Marty Blazer, who's in the series, did some groundbreaking work with his wife and just looking at, you know, the loss of diversity in our modern living versus kind of tribal people who are, you know, living off the land and eating roots, shoots, and tubers and all that. You know, we don't know exactly what the answer is, but we definitely know that we have an order of magnitude less diversity in our guts than our ancestors did and some of the people still living that way do.
And part of that is because of antibiotics, but there's other reasons as well.
Yeah, I mean, glyphosate.
Roundup,
right? This poison that's being sprayed all over GMO crops. Turns out its first use was an antibiotic. And so you're killing the life inside of you. What does that mean? It's not good. And using hand sanitizers and drinking too much chlorinated water. I mean, there's a lot of things that are antibiotic in use that have, you know, saved lives, let's be fair, but also have, you know, there's a baby bathwater scenario here, right? And so, you know, we're starting to say, okay, you know what? We have to have a very different approach to sanitation now. And think about it, you know, in the old days, people got sick because they, you know, got their leg chopped off or something. And, you know, people did die of illness and there was a lot of that. But when a lot of the big nasty stuff started to show up was when we started becoming concentrated urban folk living in these cities, dumping sewage out of our windows onto the street. And all of a sudden the rats are infested. And it was a sanitation thing. And so what really stopped this was
Chlorination,
sanitation, plumbing, yeah. Those types of things. I mean, those really saved the day. Modern medicine, sure, it works really well for emergency situations, and there's a place for antibiotics, absolutely. But, I mean, we live in a world where chronic disease is what's tearing us down. And so chronic disease has a very different lens you got to look through. And the more we look, the more we realize that the friends and the symbiotic organisms that are supposed to be with us, when they're missing, we're not well.
Right. In the same way, I mean, I don't want to over-analogize this, but in the same way that if you live in an apartment and never get outside, you're not well either. I mean, the necessity, both kind of psychological and physical, of being in nature cannot be overstated. And this work is part of that. Like, let's say you take a course of antibiotics for an illness that you couldn't have gotten rid of otherwise. And I probably wouldn't be alive if it weren't for antibiotics. I mean, I had some fairly bad illnesses over the course of my life, so I'm grateful for them. Okay. So then my inner gut bacteria are wiped out, or to a large extent wiped out. How do you then recolonize? I mean, everybody talks about taking acidophilus, but that's just one of many kinds of bacteria with which to recolonize your gut.
Yeah, and that's really the trillion-dollar question, and that's where, you know, the supplement cowboys have kind of jumped on it and have just, you know, here's my pill for everything.
And made a lot of money,
and, you know, it's like, you know, there's a lot of buzz, there's a lot of hype, and a lot of people, you know, are quick to make a buck there. The short answer would be, we don't know yet. But the better answer, if you talk to, because the research scientists all say, we don't know, it's too soon to tell. But when you talk to the functional medicine docs, the ones that are kind of, you know, on the street, they're the beach upon which all these, you know, cases splash up. They look at me and say, look, absolutely probiotics work. And you just got to know which ones. And so I'm a big fan of Viome, which is a test that does RNA sequencing to really kind of establish what you've got in your gut and then what, you know, you need more of and what you need to eat more of and less of and all that. So it has to do with eating the right foods, eating lots of ferments, having prebiotic fibers, having, you know, lots of fiber in general, but then just, you know, really getting into this realm of specificity. And that's why I think that the game has changed with some of this testing that's come out. And so, you know, I have, you know, this app on my phone that, you know, I send in stool samples every once in a while, and it just tells me which colonies are flourishing and which foods I need to eat more of to kind of, you know, bring balance, and which foods I need to avoid. And then there's targeted kind of probiotic therapy that can happen there, but with some intelligence instead of the spray and pray, which is, you know, kind of where the industry's been.
Do you ever see situations where there's like a non-optimal set of bacteria that's colonized the gut and they show up? It's a great place for them to live, but they don't really do a lot. They're like lazy house guests who just kind of like moved in, but they're not really doing their job. Does that happen?
Sure. I mean, that happens all the time. It just depends on what you're feeding, right? Every type of bacteria has a type of food that they like, and there's other kind of bacteria that balance them. And, you know, again, it's a community. There's, you know, people in the community that are less active and, you know, stay in their houses and watch TV, and there's other ones that are, you know, causing trouble. And so if you look at it as an ecosystem, then it just becomes about how you are a better kind of forester or shepherd of your bug, you know, depending on what metaphor you want to use, and just looking at the balance and being like, okay, well, we know these types of bacteria help create, you know, short chain fatty acids that we need. These ones help us digest our food. And so just helping reinforce the better neighbors and not feeding the ones that kind of sit idle. But there's a lot that we can say right now are sitting idle, but there's just so many variables that maybe their presence is helping the pathway of this other bacteria that is producing something that's really relevant and useful for us right now, as I'm deeming relevant and useful, because we just don't understand their place in the chorus. Because it's just too early to tell, right? It's just, we're really just starting to figure this out. We know that this is the future. We know that you know, the metabolome and this kind of postbiotics, and everyone's really excited about this. The pharmaceuticals are jumping up and down. Everyone knows that this is the future of medicine, but it's still very early. So we're still figuring out how they all communicate. It's a big data play, really, because there's just trillions and trillions of combinations. And so now AI is coming in to help.
Are there any kinds of new technologies that are aiding in the study of this particular field?
Oh, yeah. The SNP sequencing and the ability to do interventional work with gene SNPs into bacteria to help produce different things. And so there's a whole nanotech component that's amazing. So this technology that this company that I use is using, they took this very sophisticated RNA sequencing that was being used by the Defense Department for like biowarfare to test to see, like, hey, did we just get attacked by some biowarfare? And they used that and they applied it across the spectrum to the bugs in our gut. And so it's interesting to look at DNA, sure, but really when you look at RNA, what that does is it looks at what's actively expressing. So RNA is, you know, what's happening, the action that's happening. So when you start looking at the RNA of what's in the gut, not just of bacteria, but, you know, nematodes, protozoa, virus, everything, like just RNA in general, it gives a very different picture of what's happening versus just what's there and what's expressing. And then you could start to make changes. And then you take that kind of technology and you couple it with the computational power that we have in, you know, the computers that we have with AI and the ability to take all these data points and analyze them. It's starting to get really interesting.
Does this work, and I know it's early on and there's not probably the kinds of therapies that there might be in 5 years, 10 years or later, but is there a suggestion of alternatives to antibiotics for virulent pathogens?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've been looking at, turns out essential oils are amazing and have amazing antibiotic, antiviral effects. There's all kinds of botanicals that we know do this. And so for the treatment of SIBO.
SIBO?
Small intestine bacterial overgrowth, which is starting to hockey stick rise and all sorts of people getting diagnosed with it now. And again, it's how many times do you have to go on antibiotics before, you know, the bad guys kind of set up shop. And so we are looking at these botanicals, and there's some really promising data coming back from the front line saying, look, this worked. And then we put them on, you know, kombucha and ferments and they're fine. And so antibiotics, again, look, if you're dying, antibiotics will save your life, right? If you have a really bad infection, sometimes it calls for it, right? But not every time you get a cough, not every time you get a sinus infection, not every, you know, little dumb thing that comes along. Good doctors are becoming very wary of the overuse of antibiotics for good reason.
Right, right. Now, one of the things that you were talking about before was that people in different parts of the world have more diverse microbiomes. Are microbiomes regional? Like, let's say I grow up in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and, you know, let's say I have a healthy childhood and I play in the dirt and all the stuff that now they're saying is a good thing to do. You play in the dirt, you eat lots of things, you don't get overzealous about a kind of sterility mentality. And then you develop and you don't take too many antibiotics, you develop a healthy microbiome. Let's say there's another kid who grew up just that way in Nigeria or Peru, do they have similar microbiomes? Are they like region specific? Do we know?
Some similar, some region specific. And so there's this whole thing about fecal grafting, fecal transplants, basically. It's like you take some healthy person's poop and then you know, kind of get it injected into your large intestine. It's like unbelievable results with C. diff and certain other things we're starting to see.
C. diff?
It's a really bad C. difficile. It's a really bad infection of the GI, which is really, really challenging. And, you know, antibiotics don't really, you know, it doesn't respond well to antibiotics. So we're finding that you take the poop of someone healthy, you wipe everything out, you take the poop of someone healthy, put it back in, boom, it's gone. Right, like almost, I think it's like 90% efficacy. It was unbelievable, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, we're doing this. But we're also finding it for anxiety. We're finding it for depression. We're finding it for all kinds of other things. And so the question is, wow, can we just do this wholesale all around? Can I just take healthy people poop, put in unhealthy people, and they're just better? Kind of, but no. Because look, if I go to like, you know, the Hadza tribe and you know, say, okay, you guys have the cleanest poop we know, and you just eat, you know, roots and shoots and tubers, and you've never seen a diesel truck, and do a fecal graft there within a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, I've killed them all off because I went back to eating Twinkies and Ding Dongs and whatever it is I eat in the West, and I'm not feeding them the tubers and the roots and the sticks and whatever it is that those people are eating that are specifically feeding those bugs. So if you're not eating the diet that that person ate, you're right back to square one for the most part. And look, we're at 10% of the fiber consumption of our ancestors or some of these tribes. So yes, if you could eat a lot more fiber, it helps, but also the specific fibers that those bacteria eat are sometimes regional.
And so you would get, I mean, fecal transplant, it sounds so gross, but I've heard it work. My friend did it on her, had a veterinarian do it on her dog, and her dog got better. I mean, it's a real thing. So you want it to be from somebody close by, but at the same time, you have to, I mean, how does that work? You then have to still change your diet to something healthier?
So, I mean, you want it to be from someone close by is actually starting to come under question. I you know, in the series, we talked to a company that would just, you know, had healthy people that didn't get sick and went through, you know, kind of a very, you know, specific testing to make sure that they were healthy. And then their poop was what was just being donated and used for everybody. And it was working just fine for C. diff. Now, the question is, if I'm depressed and took the Dalai Lama's poop, would that make me feel better? And there's some studies suggesting that the answer is yes. But I also think, and it's early on, but I also think that the data is still suggestive of the fact that you still need to eat like the Dalai Lama eats.
Right.
So there is no magic pill. You know, they call them crapsules now. Like, you know, so you could take this stuff orally, you can take it rectally, or you could take it through a tube, like going down your throat, like into the upper GI. But at the end of the day, it doesn't excuse you from having to, you know, kind of clean up your lifestyle and stop eating processed junk.
Let's talk for a moment about the human microbiome and the soil microbiome. So in plants that are grown in organic or biodynamic or regenerative settings where they're very much from living soil that's not killed with chemicals and all that, you have all these little creatures that sound a lot like the ones you mentioned at the beginning that are in our guts around the root systems of plants, and they help those plants to be healthy. What is the connection between that microbiome and ours?
So they serve each other, they feed each other. Once in a while, there's some crossover, but specifically, when a plant takes photons from the sun and it photosynthesizes and creates a carbohydrate, we think that a lot of that belongs to the plant. We've come to realize that the plant actually pushes those carbohydrates down into its root nodules to feed the bacteria, which symbiotically live in the root nodules and then help break down the minerals, break down the rock, basically. And so they turn the dirt into soil. And so that soil is filled with life, and it's filled with fulvic and humic acid and these things that then start creating kind of the precursors to biology. And they extract minerals from the rocks. And as they do so, then the nutrients and the phytonutrients and everything in the plants become healthy. And a lot of those bugs also kind of translate over. It's not like you pick a carrot and you sterilize it. You dust it off and you eat it. And they also coexist in our guts. And so we're just starting to grasp the enormity of this cycle, right? And it's not just, you know, the bacteria. There's fungus, there's protozoa, there's, you know, certain parasites have been proven to help with, you know, health conditions, you know, all over. And it's just like, well, I thought parasites were bad. It turns out that they are good in certain contexts. And so again, it's all interwoven. It's all interconnected. We don't know exactly what the heck is going on, but we do know. Every good scientist I've talked to on this journey does pretty much hold the same kind of understanding that's like, well, you know what? Nature's been kind of at this for a long time, and nature's kind of figured it out. And just because we don't understand it doesn't mean it's not right. So, you know, because scientists are like, well, we don't know enough. It's not conclusive. Well, you know what? If I have to wait 20 years for the science to catch up, my daughter is going to be way past, you know, she's going to be in her reproductive years, and I've missed everything in this era where I could have helped her, right? And so what do I do for my kid?
What do you
now?
Do?
They play. We have an organic garden. They play out in the yard. They're eating, you know, vegetables that come either from our garden or from the CSA that's delivered. We don't give them processed foods, and you know they're not allowed to walk around barefoot on the street in the front because that's where the tar and the nasty chemicals are. And so we do as much as we can to help offset that. And we also, you know, I give them certain things like zeolites and different things to help conjugate, like lots of spirulina, to help pull out the stuff that they're exposed to, just because we live in a dirty world.
Right. Right. Now, the people who have the cleanest and most diverse, biodiverse gut systems, are they also freer from the kind of chronic illnesses that are so common here, like allergies, depression, arthritis, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, those kinds of things?
They tend to be, yes. And again, it's a very big blanket statement because it's hard to talk about longevity studies to be like, oh my God, they just live longer, because a lot of times they also die in their 30s because a lion ate them, or you know what I mean? Like they have a very different lifestyle. So it's very hard to compare across the populations. But yes, to your question specifically, they tend to have far less chronic disease, if any at all.
So what are some practical things that ordinary people who are listening right now might do to really think, not only for their kids, I mean, because kids are, you know, they're developing a gut system, they're growing and so on, but we're adults set in our ways, and our guts are kind of set in their ways. And I notice sometimes when I try to eat something healthier, I can't do it too quickly because making big changes are sometimes difficult and don't work very well. They'll make you feel good, at least right away. So how can people like transition into reestablishing a healthier inner ecological sort of ecosystem?
So just on the note that you said about the children, I think it's really important, is pretty much every expert I interviewed along this journey said that, look, the first 3 years are critical, the most important. That's when you kind of build your seed colony. Everything you do after that is kind of within kind of like the middle, the mean, but it's not, you know, you can make huge, profound changes in the first 3 years. So if you got a kid that's within those first 3 years, your ears better be perked up here, right? But then for the rest of us, right? Like, you know, we don't have a place in heaven, right? Like, so how do we come back? It starts with just good, clean hygiene. And I mean hygiene in the natural way, which is you just look, if you're eating processed food, you're asking for it. So stop eating processed food, stop eating GMOs, stop eating non-organic, eat less meat if you can't afford the good stuff. Only eat meat that hasn't been fed with all these hormones. And there's all sorts of chemicals that are put into feed stock that we don't even they don't even tell us about.
And prophylactic antibiotics.
And prophylactic antibiotics makes no sense at all to me. I mean, look, if you're in a situation where, you know, it's life-threatening, that's one thing. But, you know, hand sanitizers and all that. So you know, just you got to get out of this antibiotic culture. And then one of the things that also, you know, is very good news for the cardiologist, or bad news for their business, really, is you just got to eat a lot more vegetables. Man, we just don't eat enough vegetables. Our ancestors ate predominantly vegetables, not grains and processed flours and things that we eat. So as you start to bring up the fiber and mix it up, the colors, mix up all the types of vegetables, that tends to be very supportive of that. And then ferments, whether it be yogurt and kombucha or kimchi or sauerkraut or whatever it is, just fermented foods go a long way. As you start having more ferments and more vegetables, sometimes it gets uncomfortable. And then, you know, again, it's good to do a gut test to see, because sometimes you need to maybe take out some of the bad players. Botanicals can work great. There's black walnut husk. There's a bunch of things that can work for that. But it's good to understand what's going on. Because if you're eating this way and it's making you feel kind of bloated and crappy, it's probably because you're also feeding some of the bad players, and you got to start, you know, there's specific carbohydrate diet. There's various, you know, there's all kinds of strategies that work along these lines. But, you know, I'm careful not to oversimplify things, because, you know, we just live in a complicated world with lots of, you know, inputs, and lots of people have kind of, you know, they've run the miles that they've run. So, but, you know, working with a good qualified functional medicine doctor can really help unravel this.
The web series, is it a film series or a web series? Tell us about the film Interconnected.
Yeah, so it's a 10-part series. It's built for TV, but we're gonna debut it on the web, because I believe that this information should be free. And so we're going to do a 10-day free screening of it for people who can be there this November. And then, yeah, there's deals to be made with the networks and stuff like that. But, you know, my job here is to make sure this information gets out there as broadly as possible, because this really is... you know, your Main Street doctor won't be talking about this for 20 years, because it takes that long for this information to get to Main Street. And, you know, we just don't have that kind of time. So, right. You know, I do the work that can scale and help the world as fast as possible. And this subject matter has been intriguing me for years. And, you know, we pushed in our chips, and we're really happy with the information that's come. It's going to save and change many, many lives.
There's also a kind of profoundly metaphorical element to this whole thing. I mean, it's called interconnected, and it makes me think, I mean, not only about the microbiome and the root systems, but then various species in ecosystems being interconnected, and then people in different countries who are interconnected. And it's all part of the same basic sort of paradigm shift.
It really is. I mean, if you look at what's happening on a kind of a planetary scale, in a biological terms, when you start to lose these colonies, you start to lose tolerance as different things come in, and they start to kind of, you know, hit your body. Your body just doesn't react the same way, because it doesn't have that cushion of that kind of life web there. And so you become intolerant to more foods, you become intolerant to more chemicals, you just become globally more intolerant. And we're seeing that psychologically and sociologically as well, which to me is kind of profound. Again, you know, now we're just kind of extrapolating and getting into, you know, theories that are interesting. But I would put it to you that people who start to build up the diversity and the resilience of their systems tend to become both physiologically and psychologically and sociologically more tolerant. They become better neighbors. And we're seeing a reflection of, maybe it's just wholesale antibiotic use, maybe it's whatever it is, we're seeing that kind of reflected out in the political sphere. We're seeing it reflected everywhere right now. And I think that, you know, this is nature kind of calling us back, and it's time for us to listen.
Pedro Mshojai is an author, teacher, filmmaker. The new film series is called Interconnected. It debuts in a couple of months. If people want to find out more, is there a website they can go to?
Yeah, it'll debut through well.org. So there's interconnectedseries.com, which is where it'll be, but we'll have updates on well.org all the time. And it'll be this November.
Pedram, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community, and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.